bag, etc. Over the years, we've been very lucky enough, clever enough to secure most of the A-list celebs we wanted, as well as giving a chance and a picture in Grazia or the Evening Standard magazine to some wonderful up-and-coming talent as well, just to mix things up. This was all going like clockwork, and so by our third year, we were on a roll. Agents and publicists were now calling us to get an invite or a guest presenter spot for their celebrity clients. And we were now free to choose some really big names for our award nominees and be confident they would accept. Our award categories had settled into a familiar pattern by now as well, and it had become established that one of the most prestigious awards of the evening was for classic beauty. The award winner was always an established model or actress with classic looks and impeccable style. The first couple of years, the award had been given to Jay Jagger and Paloma Faith. This year, the vote had been a tie between Yasmin Le Bon and Elle Macpherson. But we did not want to weaken the accolade by making them share it. Instead, we saw this as a great opportunity to create a special new award, Woman of the Year, to give to Elle to acknowledge all she had achieved in the beauty and fashion industries, while Yasmin will be the worthy sole winner of the Classic Beauty Award. Well, Elle and Yasmin are both huge names in fashion. They both confirmed attending through their agents. But we've heard that story before. One of the biggest challenges when putting together a Rodial Beautiful Awards was the last-minute cancellation of winners. This was to be expected. All events experience cancellations on the day, but it creates a ripple of issues through other factors related to the event. For example, if a winner cancels, the presenter of the award needs to be briefed last minute to change the wording of their intro with the suitable, "I'm afraid they can't be with us tonight as they're shooting a new campaign in blah blah," or "they've sent us this message." As a result, the award announcement runs smoothly, and it looks like we knew all along that we would have to find someone relatable to the winner to accept on their behalf. It can be quite a scramble, but as I've learned, it's all part and parcel of the business of awards. So having experienced this before, and with my natural cautiousness, I was worried whether either Yasmin Le Bon or Elle Macpherson would cancel, but hopefully not both. Thankfully, both of them made it and each got their own award, giving the most graceful acceptance speeches. I will always remember the moment when Elle accepted her award and made a beautiful speech talking about how she was thrilled to be recognized at that stage of her career and that she was pleased to be part of an evening that was all about women who were inspiring others and running successful businesses. Year four was the most stressful of all. After the success of the category for Elle the previous year, we reintroduced it for the next year and the panel vote for Women of the Year went to Kate Moss. I got straight on to her agent to confirm that she'd be attending to receive her award. The agent said that unfortunately she wouldn't attend. To be fair, it wasn't just about diaries. I would have been surprised if she did attend, as she was under contract to Rimmel, and showing up at our event to get a Rodial award would probably be a breach of contract. However, one of my people at work claimed that they were best buddies with Kate and she would definitely attend the awards. I was skeptical, but this was someone I trusted. She said that she was in touch with her directly. In fact, stop talking to the agent. I'm best friends with Kate and she has told me she's definitely going to be there. Okay, why should I doubt my employee? Yes, you've guessed it. The evening started and Kate was nowhere to be seen. I should have gone with my instincts and more importantly with my experience. Luckily, my experience also meant we could save it. I knew that James Brown, Kate's hairdresser, was there, and he agreed to pick up the award for her. It was all seamless, apart from the heightened stress levels, of course. The fifth Rodial Beauty Awards were the best ever. By that time, we'd moved the location for the awards to a larger space on St. Martin's Lane, turned it into a sit-down dinner, appointed Laura Whitmore as a presenter, and even hired Sean Canning, one of the UK's most renowned awards scriptwriters, to put together the script for the whole evening. By now, the Rodial Awards had become a firm fixture on the beauty and fashion industry calendar, and we had connections with all the major agents. Every January, we'd start getting calls asking when the awards were happening, so they could suggest which of their clients would be available and push for invites of new ones. There's always a new movie, a new campaign, or a new album to sell, and celebrities need to be seen at the right events with the right crowd, such as the Rodial Beautiful Awards. They are the perfect opportunity to boost a celebrity profile. By year five, we were saying no more often than yes to guest list additions, and the Rodi or Beautiful Awards had developed a reputation as one of the most glamorous and sophisticated events in London. Our international PR agencies wanted to take the awards to New York, LA, Europe and Asia, so we were onto something. There are so many elements that go into creating an event of such a size. From the production and build, to scripts and running of the show, to menu choices, music, live performances, guest list management, seating, VIP seating and panel selection. Everyone wants to be invited, friends of friends of friends, which can make it tough to accommodate everyone, leaving some people unhappy. We'd have people who have attended the awards one year, but have not made the guest list the next. Another issue we faced, which I hadn't anticipated, was the reaction of some nominees who got very upset that they did not win their categories, especially bloggers. At one awards, when we announced the winner of the beauty blogger category, a nominee stormed out of the awards, evidently presuming she was going to win, and then immediately unfollowed us on social media. Others would express their disappointment publicly on Twitter and diss the awards. What is it with bloggers? You know that moment at the Oscars where the screen splits into four as they announce the winner and the three losers all graciously applaud? I would love to have seen that screen during our blogger category. It would have been far more entertaining. Anyhow, by year five, we had endured enough, and we decided not to include any bloggers in our categories. They were taking everything way too personally and posting all their bile online, so it was a lose-lose situation for us. Another category that we dropped was for the makeup artists. This was another category that created resentment if the nominees didn't win, although they weren't as bad as the bloggers. And as we work with a lot of makeup artists as a brand, we were making fewer friends and more enemies. The awards in 2014 were our last. By that time, we had raised the brand's awareness, but felt that it had become a bit of a publicity game. It just didn't feel right anymore. As it was the best year ever, it was a good way to bow out. Another element of hosting the awards was that I got to connect with existing celebrity fans of the brand or make new ones. I met Daisy Lowe at the fifth Rodi or Beautiful Awards. She won the ultimate award that year, the Woman of the Year. She was part of that London It crowd, the 20-something group including Alexa Chung and Cara Delevingne that looked effortless and fashionable, and everyone wanted a piece of them. Daisy was very sweet at the awards and we immediately hit it off. She sent me a bouquet of beautiful flowers the day afterwards with a note, and I thought, how charming, and then bumped into her a few times in the next few months and loved her energy and effortless style. It was May 2014, and we were planning our autumn campaign to launch our new sculpting and contouring makeup range. I wanted to make a statement, to make everyone pay attention to our makeup as if it was a new range, rather than an extension of our existing skincare. What do the big brands do when they want to make a statement? They hire a celebrity and make her the face of the brand. With every success, there's always added pressure to deliver. And we needed to deliver on creating buzz around makeup. It wasn't going to be just sending some powders and mascaras over to the press. We needed something bigger. I was at the office and brainstorming with my marketing and PR team. What shall we do? How do we make a statement? We started discussing bringing in a celebrity. We were just starting out a campaign with Millie McIntosh for Nip and Fab, and we didn't yet have any results on press or sales to justify making another investment. But we didn't have the time to wait. The results of the Millie campaign would be known by October, and the makeup was launching early November. The planning of a campaign shoot takes a month, then another few weeks to select and get the pictures ready, and you need to present to the press 3 months before the launch to catch the long lead time of monthly magazines. We needed to make a decision there and then and take that risk if we were to make the deadlines. We talked about a few options. We decided to focus on a UK personality as makeup was initially launching in the UK. It wouldn't be launched in the US for another year. This already narrowed it down to a few people: Alexa Chung, Kate Moss, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley and Daisy Lowe. Alexa was already working with a few beauty brands, Kate was still with Rimmel, and Rosie was all over the press with Marks & Spencer. Also, I always like to know all the personalities with whom we work, and having met and liked Daisy, I thought she would make an excellent choice. When you want to work with a personality, you deal with their agent or manager. You negotiate everything from the duration of the contract to the number of days they will represent the brand. Shoot, press, interviews and appearances, hair and makeup budget, travel arrangements, even the number of days within which the talent has to approve the pictures. The brand wants the pictures ASAP, and the personality always tries to negotiate as much time as they can to approve these. My PR team worked with her manager to agree on the details. We started negotiations during the summer, and it was challenging with all of us being away at different times. So by September, we still didn't have a signed contract in place. While we were dealing with the legal elements of the agreement, we were also planning the photo shoot for mid-October. We booked the photographer and a stylist and brought in everyone at our offices to discuss mood and style. I cut out some pages from French Vogue of a really cool shoot I liked that was very moody and the clothes were edgy with a French twist. The team was ready to go and we would shoot at the Work Studios in Parsons Green, London. We would shoot Daisy with two different looks, a day and an evening sculpt, and four different outfits. It was now a week before the shoot and we still hadn't signed the contract. There were a few details that we thought were minor, but they weren't to the other party and the negotiations dragged on for much longer than we thought. A few days before the shoot, I was invited to a fashion party and I bumped into Daisy and her manager. Things were a bit tense as we were all ready to go, but no contract was signed. We had a quick chat and I reassured them that it was going to happen and I was looking forward to working with Daisy. Sometimes lawyers tend to complicate things, and this was the situation. I felt we cleared the air with that conversation. The next day, the contract was signed by both parties. The day of the shoot arrived. At Works, everyone was very excited but stressed, as not only were we shooting a personality, we were also shooting makeup looks with our new makeup. Every look had to work with the hair and the outfit, and if not coordinated, this could be a disaster. What I love about shoots these days is that there's a laptop where the pictures immediately load and you can see exactly what's being shot and what the pictures look like. The pictures looked great. As part of our contract with Daisy, we had agreed to develop a limited edition glam stick, a high pigmented lip butter with a tint, with the name Just Daisy. We wanted to launch the product in January 2015 for the second quarter of Daisy's contract with us. If we could dictate the timing, we would have ordered the product in August, giving us time for the press samples to be ready in October and the finished product ready for the stores in January. Because we didn't have a contract with Daisy until October, but we needed to have a product ready, we looked at some of her press pictures and developed a colour that looked like the sort that she would wear. We placed the order in August. On the day of the shoot, my product development manager came to me very excited, holding a glam stick in her hands. It was the brand new Just Daisy glam stick. The timing couldn't have been better. She took the glam stick to Daisy. Daisy took my PR aside to talk. I could sense something was wrong. Daisy didn't like her lipstick colour and thought it didn't represent her. I had a look at the colour myself and I have to say, it was supposed to be a reddish coral and it was more of a dirty orange. It wasn't great. I immediately called the office to see what was the situation. We had approved the colour, but at times there's a slight difference in the final product. Well, we need to change this, my team said. We had only produced the press products, which were a couple of hundred, so no big deal. We can redo the whole production in a new colour. There was silence. My product manager said, we have a problem. As it was a limited edition, the factory ran the whole 5,000 pieces, and we now have the entire stock in our warehouse. I couldn't believe it. I was taking risks every day with my business, and this was a risk that just hadn't paid off. I had 5K units of glam stick that I couldn't sell. Okay, fine. Breathe. Think. For starters, Let's get a new color and get our Just Daisy made right. Then we can deal with this stock. It wasn't just that we had to bin 5,000 items. We also needed to move fast to get a new version ready for January. We had a disaster on our hands. The team worked closely with Daisy to develop a color that she liked, and we nailed it within a week and produced the entire run within 3 months. Which wasn't quite January, it was February by the time we got everything done, but it wasn't the showstopper we feared. It was still done in time to be within contract. What did we do with the 5K overstock? We removed the Just Daisy labels and gave it away as gratis to our stores and staff. I never want to waste product. A week after the campaign shoot, we selected the pictures and invited the press for interviews. Daisy and I took over the library at the Soho Hotel. We had all the top beauty editors, including those at Grazia and InStyle magazine. And Daisy talked about her beauty routine while I spoke about why I picked her to be the face of our new makeup range and what the range was all about. It was all very fun and informal and a great day. Each journalist selected the pictures they liked for their feature, and articles started coming out in a few weeks. It was all really exciting as we were getting press both for our makeup and about Daisy being the face of our launch campaign. Among the key products for the campaign were our luxury powders, packed in to die for compacts. The compacts incorporated textured vegan leather and shiny silver hardware and our big R for Rhodiol. The compacts looked stunning, and they were now the hero product of our makeup range. The powders themselves, contouring, bronzing, highlighting, and perfecting in a variety of shades, have become some of our best-selling items and are consistently featured in magazines and winning awards. They're loved by celebrity makeup artists worldwide and used by the likes of Mario Dedivanovic on Kim Kardashian, and it's a staple of his masterclasses. Val Garland uses it on the models when she's creating catwalk looks for the various fashion shows. Through the awards and celebrity associations, we were able to get the word out about our products to a different market that doesn't follow the beauty pages and now became aware of our brand and products. Overnight success secret number 8. How to organize a successful PR event. There's nothing like holding a successful PR event to generate buzz about your business. Over the years, I've organized all sorts of events, from PR breakfasts to bloggers' cocktail parties to VIP dinners to masterclasses. You put a lot of time, energy, and money into these events, but if you do them right, the buzz that you get is totally worth it. These are my top 10 tips for organizing a buzz-worthy event. 1. Find a reason for the event. It could be anything from launching a new product to celebrating a business anniversary, a holiday, or season of the year, or even a collaboration. It's not hard to find a reason, but you really need one to throw an event. 2. Be very clear at the beginning what you want to achieve. To get press coverage for your product, introduce your product to influencers, get coverage in the social pages, or get tagged on lots of Instagram pictures. Write down what your goals are so you can plan accordingly. 3. Decide on the number of people and the type of event. Think about people's schedules and the likelihood they would attend an event. Breakfasts and drinks are the easiest as people can go before or after work. I find lunches to be the most challenging. In the time it takes to travel to the venue, drinks, then sit down to a 2- or 3-course meal and then make your way back, that's half the day gone. If your target market is ladies who lunch, then you'd be spot on. 4. Find a venue that suits the style of your brand. If you have a cool, edgy brand, you want a venue that represents it and nothing too corporate or traditional. It's all in the details. People always like to go to a new venue. So if there's something new and exciting and it fits your brand and your budget, go for it. 5. During the first few years of the business, we organized all the events with an internal team. We still organize some of the more intimate events ourselves. We just ensure we have enough pairs of hands for the event, and we enlist the help of people outside the PR team to help. Other staff are all excited to be part of an event, and you get a lot of volunteers. Make sure everyone knows their exact job when they're there. Allocate roles in advance. 6. Branding of the venue is important. It has to look like your event. Anything from a welcome poster on arrival, branded goodie bags and products thrown around the space are easy ways to dress a room. Mix it up with some flowers and you're good to go. 7. Don't forget to remind your guests of your social media handles and general hashtags, as well as any special hashtag for the evening. You need all the social media support you can get. 8. A step and repeat. A wide wall where your logo is repeated, as shown at red carpet events, is a great way to get some branding into the room and ensure that your logo is in photographs. If the space allows, your guests will feel like they're walking the red carpet, and that means more pictures and social media impressions. 9. These days we use Evites for most of our events, but it's always a nice touch if you send a handwritten note to some of your top guests. If you want to send an invitation card, then go for something really special, using an unusual paper finish, color, or material to make an impact. Oversized invites are always fabulous. 10. Enjoy the time. This is easier said than done. I always tend to worry at my events. Will my guests show up? Will they have a good time, etc.? I'm becoming better at this, but I still tell myself to relax and enjoy. Chapter 9. The Kardashian Factor. I was never a fan of the Keeping Up with the Kardashian show. I've watched a few scenes over the years while switching channels, but I never watched an entire episode from start to finish. That doesn't mean it's bad, I'm just more of a House of Cards gal, that's all. I knew about the family through the various media stories that surfaced, and was always impressed at how they work social media, Twitter and then Instagram, to become the first Insta-famous personalities with thousands of selfies and millions of followers. Over the last couple of years, I started noticing the two younger sisters, Kendall and Kylie Jenner. They had followed a similar route to fame as the rest of the Kardashian clan, exposure on the TV show, followed by a masterful social media presence, and they too had begun to build a career for themselves outside of the show. I'd seen Kendall walk at the Chanel shows, and her younger sister Kylie endorse a hair range. I saw them in Time magazine among the most influential teens of 2014, and the more I saw, the more I thought that there was something really cool about them. So I joined millions of others who obviously felt the same and started following them on Instagram. And apart from liking the odd selfie, that, as far as I was aware at the time, was that. Months later in 2014, I was casually flicking through Instagram posts, and there was Kylie at a shoot in LA. And what had she posted? Only a picture of the Nip and Fab glycolic fix. Woohoo! This was brilliant. Over the years, we've gifted makeup artists with both Rodial and Nip and Fab products, so it wasn't unusual for them to show up at a shoot, and we quite frequently get unexpected feedback that a certain celebrity has used one of our products and become a big fan. Sometimes we hear about it, sometimes we don't, but it's always a thrill when we do. Now, there are a couple of reasons why she may have posted the product pic. It may be that she absolutely loved the product and couldn't wait to tell the world, "This is my preferred scenario." Or it could be that she just needed material for her daily feed. Either way, this was an amazing piece of exposure for our brand. At the time, Nip and Fab was a relatively unknown brand in the US, and Kylie had just Instagrammed us to her 22 million followers, which in turn led to over 500,000 likes. Needless to say, after pausing to do a little dance around the kitchen, I immediately reposted it on our own social media. That one post was the beginning of a very exciting journey between Kylie and Nip and Fab. The result of the post was not just a lot of interest on our own at Nip and Fab handle, but also for our brand in general. The calls and email traffic we got from people wanting to find out more about our products went up dramatically, and this pushed the button on something I'd been thinking about for a while, namely using influencers to help enhance the brand. The internal debate had gone back and forth a few times on whether it would be best to go with a traditional celebrity, model, film star, singer, etc., or align with a purely digital talent like Zoella, millions of followers, zeitgeist, etc. Here, all of a sudden, was Kylie Jenner, seemingly the best of both worlds. We looked at Kylie and the effect that single Instagram had on our brand, and I decided to take things to the next level. We got in touch with her agent in December 2014 and started talks. I wanted to work with her as an official Nip and Fab brand ambassador. We would build a whole event around the announcement. We'd bring her to London to meet her fans and do a series of press and social events to celebrate her association with the brand. The negotiations took 4 nail-biting months, and there were many times that I thought the deal wouldn't go through at all. Dates went back and forth. She was busy filming her show, and as you might expect for one of the most influential people of 2014, she had a few other engagements to attend. So trying to slot it all in was proving very difficult. In the meantime, while the negotiations around Kylie swirled, we had the practical business of planning an event, which, if we left it too late, would cause us even more problems. So we were looking at venues, booking hotels, planning parties, all the while not quite sure whether it was actually going to happen. Every day for the whole 4 months, I would be on the phone until late in the evening with my team getting updates from the negotiations with Team Jenner in LA. Finally, we picked Westfield in Shepherd's Bush, West London, as our key photo call and consumer venue. This is a luxury shopping centre that combines a selection of massive flagship stores for Prada, Louis Vuitton and Burberry, with a great selection of high street stores, restaurants and cinemas. It is well known, suits the brand and was available on the dates that Kylie wanted. The venue was booked. Everything was in place for the 14th of March 2015 for our 24 hours with Kylie in London. Well, not quite. During our negotiations with venues and hotels, we had played our cards very close to our chests. We didn't want news of Nip and Fab's new brand ambassador getting leaked, so we hadn't told Westfield who our celebrity was going to be. Loose lips sink ships, as they say. We had mentioned it would be a big name, and we'd let them know that security would be needed. They've had a lot of A-list names at Westfield in the past, so this was well within their normal event protocol. With a week to go, we had a final production meeting at Westfield with their event manager and security. We started to talk about cars and escorting the talent to the stage and so forth, and thought it only polite to tell them who they should be looking out for. "It's Kylie Jenner," I said proudly. There was an uncomfortable silence. "You know, from the Kardashians." I smiled for extra emphasis, but this last bit seemed to make the atmosphere even more tense. Finally, the event manager spoke. "The Kardashian family are banned from Westfield, I'm afraid." "Kill me now." Yes, so it seems I missed the headlines in November 2012 when Kim, Khloe and Courtney launched their Dorothy Perkins fashion collaboration with Philip Green. They'd planned a signing in the main event space and the event had turned to chaos as thousands of teenage fans, having queued through the night, broke through the police barriers and mobbed the malls. Several casualties and fainting teens later, Westfield had called time on having any more Kardashian-related events at the centre. I had to save the Nip and Fab event. Too many wheels were already in motion. We were running a competition for customers to come along and be a VIP. The press had been sent save-the-date invites. This event had to stay on the rails. I guess they sensed my desperation. "Okay," they agreed, "the event could go ahead, but you're going to need to triple the security. We need to inform the police. We need ambulances on standby." The list went on, and the bill went up. I simply could not afford to spend that much money. We kept talking. The problem with the 2012 event was that it was public, with lots of promotion, lots of pre-event press, and held in the main event space in the centre of the mall. Although this space was exactly where we were proposing the big reveal of our Nip and Fab star, the difference was that we hadn't actually announced it yet. Could we make this a secret, exclusive event? Well, the public event space was out of the question now. The events manager suggested we might hold it in one of their on-site cinemas. It would be a theatre setting, and we could get Kylie to and from the stage without having to walk her through the shopping centre. It'd be different, more low-key, but yes, it could work. However, we still needed to announce that it would be Kylie Jenner and tell people and press where to come. The potential that this could go viral and send thousands of Kylie Jenner fans descending on Westfield was still a problem. We decided that we would release the news that our Nip and Fab ambassador would be Kylie, but keep the venue secret until the last minute. After all, to make this worthwhile, we still needed to create a buzz with this event. If it was just Kylie and I sat in a room looking at each other, it wasn't going to get a lot of press. We officially announced the 24 Hours in London with Kylie Jenner event, and the press began to heat up. Meanwhile, it was all hands on deck to ensure everything was perfect. We had booked her and her team a suite at the Edition Hotel, and my team swapped out the hotel toiletries and decked it out with Nip and Fab products. From Nip and Fab shower gels and body creams to face cleansers and serums, along with a beautiful Smiths and Wash bag monogrammed with her initials. I wrote a note to her and left it in her room. Dear Kylie, welcome to London. I look forward to our 24 hours together. Let's rock it. Kisses, Maria. All week, right up until the moment she got on board that BA flight from LA to London, I still wasn't sure this would go through. I'd been living on the edge for 4 months. I put a lot of resources into this project as well as all my energy and needed this to be a success. It was a big risk. With 24 hours to go, we sent out the secret location details to the press, beauty industry VIPs, and our competition winners. I was enjoying the cloak and dagger. It reminded me of the secret warehouse raves I'd gone to as a student, waiting in a bar for the text to tell you where the party was. You felt in the know and special. Maybe this was better than the original concept. Kylie arrived on a Friday and went straight to the Edition Hotel. Paparazzi were waiting for her at the airport, and before I even got to meet her, a Mail Online story came up with her pictures at the airport, talking about her trip to London as the brand ambassador for Nip and Fab. Okay, this is working. She arrived with her manager Liz and her hair and makeup artist, Rob Sheppy, who joined them from Paris after spending a week taking care of Kylie's sister Kim Kardashian and her newly dyed platinum hair. We were in constant communication with Liz. Kylie wanted to do some sightseeing in London and we organised for her to visit the London Eye. My team and I went to the Edition Hotel to pick her up and, although we had spoken on the phone, this was the first time I had actually met her. Her hair and makeup were immaculate, and she was dressed in high thigh boots and a satin top. We were at the same height with me wearing my double-decker Alaya boots. Between her people and mine, there were about 10 of us, and the moment we got out of the cars at the London Eye, we were surrounded by a throng of paparazzi. Kylie and her team picked up the pace to outrun the paps, but my double-decker Alaya boots had other ideas. No way was I running anywhere. The swarming paparazzi were there at every turn, but we had a lovely afternoon, and finally, after a dinner at Nobu, we all had an early night. Tomorrow was going to be a big day. We started with a photo shoot of Kylie at the Edition Hotel for pictures that we would use to promote her role as the brand ambassador for Nip and Fab. She was ready to go at 9 a.m. sharp. Hair and makeup done and not a sign that she hadn't slept all night because of the jet lag. We were also filming the segment so we could make clips for our social media accounts and YouTube. The shoot went very smoothly, apart from the moment we looked around and realized we had lost Rob Sheppy. The room was big, but not that big. Luckily, we found him quickly enough. The next part of the day was like a blizzard. We both headed off in limos with our teams and made our way to Westfield. Men in black suits talking into their sleeves directed us through the back of the mall, where we disembarked and headed into a labyrinth of tunnels. I swear, if any of us had taken a wrong turn, I'm pretty sure we'd still be down there now. Finally, we emerged, probably through a secret Scooby-Doo-style bookcase, I don't really recall, into the VIP lounge of the cinema. Time for another photo call. And this was where the first real step of Kylie's engagement with the brand would happen. We briefly went into the green room, a separate area with drinks and sofas, where we could prep and wait until we were ready to hit the photo call. Then we stepped out to walk the red carpet. Actually, not red, but Nip and Fab blue for the occasion, and face the press pit. I couldn't believe it. There must have been 100 photographers lined up. Camera flashes strobing wildly, TV crews shouting our names for interviews and quotes. It was insane. I couldn't believe I was part of this. I looked at Kylie and was struck by how completely composed and in control she seemed. And then it hit me. Of course, she would be. This sort of attention and intensity is part of her everyday life. To me, it all seemed like a dream. In the cinema, we stepped up onto the stage for a live Q&A to warm applause and more than a few screams and whoops. As well as inviting the press, we had given away 200 tickets to Nip and Fab customers and Kylie fans through our website and social media. And it looked like our last-minute reveal of the location had worked, because they were all here. Our host for the interview was the fabulous MTV presenter, Becca Dudley. And we spoke about why we picked Kylie as the brand ambassador of Nip and Fab. Kylie talked about her favorite beauty products and style tips. The packed auditorium hung on our every word. I hoped I was making sense as I answered the questions, as I was very nervous, and all I could think was, let's just get through this. The Q&A flashed by, and before I knew it, Becca was thanking the audience, and it was all over. We headed back to the Edition restaurant for lunch with Kylie and her manager, finally free of constant attention from press and photographers. It was the first quiet moment that we had together. Batteries recharged, we headed right back into the fray with interviews and filming with Grazia and People magazines, and a lovely end to the day at a tea party co-hosted by InStyle magazine. Kylie and I took some pictures in our fun photo booth, and I was very happy to wrap up the day. The press and social media went crazy with all the content. It was a lot of planning and hard work, but definitely worth it. The products that Kylie promoted on the day were the Nip and Fab Glycolic Pads and the newly launched Nip and Fab Dragon's Blood range. The products flew off the shelves and are still on our best-selling list. Things don't always work out when you want to bring celebrities in to help promote your brand. With Nip and Fab doing well, we started to think about bringing in someone a bit more mature. Mind you, mature in the model world is not what mature is to the real world. To associate with the brand and help us capture a different audience. Ideally, it would be someone who'd be recognizable both in the UK and the US, with a good sense of style, and that the media and our fans would be interested in and able to relate to. We came up with the name of a model in her early 30s, who was a new mum and based in LA. We all got very excited. My team immediately got in touch with the people at her agency and started the negotiations. We would make her a brand ambassador for Nip and Fab. We'd launch her involvement with a campaign shoot in LA, press interviews, a launch event with step and repeat boards, the whole lot. We went back and forth on the phone and by email for a month and finally secured a date. So far, so good. These negotiations always take a lot of time. But we had pretty much everything agreed when we booked our flights to LA for the first round of PR activity with her. We were now 10 days out from the shoot and had a couple of details to finalize with her agency. My team kept emailing them, but suddenly they weren't responding. That was a bit odd. And we still needed to sign the contract. But still, this was not that unusual. When we worked with Kylie Jenner, we had finalized the contract a couple of days before and it all ran on rails. So I guess her agent is busy, not a biggie. We'll sort it nearer the time. A few days before we're scheduled to leave for LA, I wake up and, as always, the first thing I do is check my Instagram feed. I'm scrolling down, checking on last night's posts, liking this and that. And what do I see? It's an Instagram post from our soon-to-be Nip and Fab ambassador promoting a competing skincare brand and saying how much she loves their products. Wait, what? We are a week before entering into a long-term ambassadorial contract and she is announcing that she's doing digital work for the competition? It was 6 a.m. in the morning and my WhatsApp was burning up with the messages firing between me and my team, who were as shocked as I was to wake up to this. Still stabbing away at WhatsApp, I made my way to the office and called an emergency meeting with my team. Well, I didn't need to call it. They were all there ready to fight the fire. What on earth do we do now? Here was the new brand ambassador who, in our eyes, had pulled the rug from under our whole campaign. Well, thanks to her agency being completely incommunicado for the past week, we still hadn't signed the contract. Not our fault. We had been ready and willing, but it meant that legally, we could get out of this. Every relationship we cultivate with our brand ambassadors has to be based, like any relationship in fact, on trust, compatibility and mutual respect. I felt that we'd been dissed. Even if we were out of contract, posting something like that a week before our campaign may be legally okay, but it was morally dubious for sure. It ruined the integrity of the message, i.e. our newly appointed celebrity ambassador likes our brand best. There was no way we could face the press and tell that story of how she was representing Nip and Fab when a few days before she was endorsing a competing skincare brand. We had already spent a lot of money on this campaign, flights, hotels, bookings at studios and so on. But even worse, we had booked interviews and exclusive press calls, and all manner of PR relationships were now at stake. Despite all this, the feeling in the room was unanimous. We decided to pull the deal and face the consequences. Looking back, it was absolutely the right thing to do. We stood by our values and this partnership just wasn't meant to be. We let the press know. We got over it and we move forward. No regrets. Overnight success secret number 9. Influence the influencers. The key to creating buzz around your product is to get press and influencers talking about your brand. You need to get your products into the pages of the most prestigious magazines, but without paying for high-price advertising. And these days, it's even more important to get bloggers, vloggers, and Instagrammers talking about your products to create a sense of excitement and buzz. One of the best ways of influencing the influencers is to get your products into the hands of celebrities without having to pay. These are my top 10 steps. 1. Identify the celebrities that you want to approach. 2. Do some research and find out if they currently have any live contracts with big brands and, if so, in what category. 3. Narrow it down to celebrities who don't have competing contracts with your category. 4. Find out the names and addresses of their agents and publicists. 5. Send 2 sets of products, one for the agent, publicist, and one for the celebrity. 6. Write a handwritten note on a beautiful card and be nice, but not pushy. 7. Follow up with an email a week later to find out if the agent or publicist received the products and what they thought of them. 8. If you're lucky, you may get a thank you from the publicist that such and such a celeb has received your products. If you're even luckier, you may receive a thank you note from the celebrity themselves. 9. Stop communication or else this may backfire and the agent or publicist think you're a pushy weirdo. 10. When you have a new product, repeat the process. Chapter 10. Becoming Insta-famous. It's hard to remember life before social media. I joined the social media game very late. I was the last of my friends to get on Facebook and I rarely used it. I'm very private when it comes to my personal life and I didn't see the point of sharing stuff with non-friends or for that matter with friends who already knew what I was doing as I actually spoke to them. I was married and wasn't looking for love and I didn't particularly feel I needed any new friends. I had enough already and with my hectic work schedule, I had barely any time to connect with the ones I did have. I didn't get why people would post endless and usually bad quality pictures of themselves, their families and their friends partying or on holiday and have other people comment on it. Still, everyone was doing it so I reluctantly signed up to Facebook but never went on it or checked it. I would, however, use it for work to announce a new launch, a new store, a new press success, and so on. In the autumn of 2011, I came across Twitter for the first time. In case you're reading this in some alternative dimension or dystopian future where Twitter no longer exists, hard to believe, but you never know, Twitter is an online social networking service that enables users to send and read short messages called tweets. It was created in March 2006 and quickly gained worldwide popularity. As of September 2016, Twitter had 695 million users, out of which more than 342 million were active users. I love the fact that at the time, you could post only 140 characters. It's succinct, and you can run a commentary without the need of images or preparation. I also love the fact that the following doesn't need to be reciprocal. You follow who you want, and vice versa. I'd been reading about Twitter for a few months, and on the 30th of December 2012, I set up my first Twitter account and made it my New Year's resolution to make it big over the next year. I needed to pick a name. My last name is lengthy, difficult to pronounce, and almost always gets misspelt. I wanted something simple and easy, and something that reflects who I am, and came up with the handle at Mrs. Rodial. How do you start? I started following magazines, press, bloggers, and friends in the hope that they would follow me back and would move from the embarrassing 3 followers I started with to a few hundred and then to a few thousand and so on. As far as content was concerned, I was in New York with my family at the time and it was Christmas, so I had plenty of material to report on, from visits to the Met, to lunch at Cipriani, to a viewing of Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark, on Broadway. It was really fun, and I was excited to have found a social media platform that I enjoyed. From day one, I decided to keep my own account personal, and while reporting on my day-to-day life, trips, press events, celebrity friends, I wouldn't go big on promoting products unless there was something really important to me that I needed to share, like a favorite product or a beauty tip. I also loved posting inspirational messages. Sometimes by posting those messages, I was motivating myself first and then my followers. When I was back from New York in the new year, I asked my team to set up Twitter accounts for our brands. At Rodial Skincare and at Nip and Fab. The question was, who would run those accounts? Our PR department was the perfect platform, as it was dealing daily with product launches, events, celebrity endorsements, and generally all the exciting and glamorous stuff that was happening in our business. We needed to find a tone of voice that would be relevant to each brand. Rodial was more sophisticated, grown up and luxury, while Nip and Fab was younger, trendier and more informal, but they would both be run by one department. Apart from my early Luddite attitude to a personal Facebook account, I quickly learned to take social media very seriously. Today, it is how the brand is represented to the outside world, and I need to be on top of it. You can't get an intern and let them run with it. It would be a repeat of my first design agency commission. I know what is right for the brand, so I give the overall tone and direction of our social media, and my team executes. I have heard plenty of cautionary stories over the years of PR assistants live tweeting from a club on a Saturday night to the horror of the followers and their bosses. So I needed to be in control. I'm not saying my PR team are wild party animals, but you know, better safe than sorry. There was so much we could share with our followers. It was really exciting to have this platform of communication. For our Rodial Beautiful Awards, we tweeted everything from the names of the celebrity nominees to what the celebrity arrivals were wearing on the night of the awards, to who won. And when our celebrity fans tweeted about a Rodial product they loved, we would retweet that to share with our audience. However, when we first started, this was a completely new form of communication. Somehow, I had to learn all about it. No one from PR had dealt with it before. There were no social media experts back then, so I did what I always do when I face the unknown. I ordered a bunch of books from Amazon, How to Tweet, Tweeting for Dummies, etc., you get the idea, and read them over a weekend. I summarized what I read, trialled a few things out on my own at Mrs. Rodial account and sat down with my PR team on a Monday morning and took them through the do's and don'ts. I was monitoring the feed daily and gave back feedback. Another way to find out how to tweet, as with everything in life, is to watch how other people are doing it. When you first start tweeting, it does feel a bit awkward and forced, but the more you do it, the easier it becomes, and the less you worry about it, the more naturally it comes across. While the @RodialSkincare and @NippumFab accounts were run by our PR department with my input, I would run my @MrsRodial account 100% myself. I have to admit that I became obsessed with Twitter. I would vent if I had a problem that day or talk about something I was proud of, and my followers mostly responded positively. I did have the occasional negative comment, but that's social media. I was checking my timeline every hour and posting a few times a day, including early mornings, evenings, after work, and weekends. Twitter became part of my life, and I loved it. I then noticed that people were live tweeting during popular TV shows, and I loved that. I was looking forward to watching a show not just because of the show, but for the comments I would share with other people on Twitter. The X Factor was a big one. I couldn't wait for the show to start and get on with my Twitter comments. That was part of the fun. I also loved being live on Twitter when a major Hollywood event was happening, such as the Oscars or the Golden Globes, where I would comment on celebrities who were wearing our products and makeup and outfit looks. There was a sense of community on Twitter, and there were certain people whom I didn't know in real life, but I felt I knew them really well. It was as if we were all on a giant sofa watching shows and gossiping. I would always post my tweets in real time, whatever thought I had at that moment. I never planned or scripted or scheduled tweets on my personal account. It was all real and happening right now, and that made my account really exciting. I tried different tweets to test engagement. Would a tweet about a new product launch get more engagement than a tweet about an event I was attending? Some of the more typical tweets about a product just hitting the stores weren't getting as much attention as some of the more personal tweets of the type, "I just met with X to discuss our collaboration over cappuccinos." My tweeting strategy was that there was no strategy. I would post whenever I felt like it and wouldn't force a tweet if I didn't feel like it. As a result, my tweets appeared spontaneous and more direct. I would even share with my followers my New Year's resolutions, a new fitness regime, and my progress with a new diet. And they loved it. @MrsRodial became everyone's friend. Everyone loved the fly-on-the-wall approach to my life behind the scenes, and I loved being able to entertain, inspire, and motivate my followers. Managing my Twitter handle became a whole other job on top of my day job. It would be the first thing I would think about when I woke up, and the last thing I checked before I went to bed. It was full on, but I had so much fun with it. The idea of a beauty brand having a personality on social media was unique, and I was the first person to run with it. It helped make the relationship with our customers even closer and more personal. It is a platform from which I can speak more candidly about my likes and dislikes, my thoughts and ideas about new products, and our followers are less inclined to be cynical or skeptical. Why? Because it's a person and not a brand talking to them. My tweets about the brand are mixed with comments about nearly missing a flight, or going to the gym, or obsessing over a new shoe. Or whatever happens to me in my day-to-day life, regardless of whether it's related or not to the brand. It's a closeness that could not exist between a brand and its customers before, and it's exciting. It's also very authentic, as I don't really have an agenda with my personal account. I just document my everyday life, and I can channel my creativity while entertaining and inspiring our customers. It's also a bit scary to think that everything I post can be read and quoted by anyone out there. I posted a tweet when we had Kylie Jenner over in London and we spent 24 hours together, and one publication took one of my tweets as the official statement of the brand on working with Kylie. I was happy with the statement, thankfully, but that made me think, you never know who's reading your tweets. With time, I was getting a lot more confident with Twitter, and so was my team. The material was endless. From behind the scenes at the office with a new sample arriving of an exciting new colour of lipstick, to being about to sign a celebrity as the face of the brand, to covering behind the scenes of photo shoots and events. We didn't always need a picture, although at times there was such amazing material, we would have to share it. In a few months, my followers increased from a few hundred to tens of thousands, and it looked like my time on Twitter paid off. I was getting asked to do Twitter takeovers for Harvey Nichols, Stylist magazine, and a lot of international publications, and I was really enjoying it. I was asked to give talks about social media, and people started requesting my advice. I was excited that I was doing something I really enjoyed, allowing me to be creative while connecting with our customers in a very direct way. A couple of years into Twitter, I started reading about Instagram. A lot of my friends in the fashion industry were already on Instagram and were checking it out for fashion news and inspiration. My first reaction to that was, Twitter has already taken on my life. I don't have time to manage another platform. You need to be in there, my friend said. This is where all the fashion and cool people are. I had a look at it to check out how it worked. I loved the fact that there were pictures, but it would involve a big commitment of my time to put a beautiful gallery together. I signed up, still using the @MrsRodial handle, which was my signature by then. I'm never one to do something half-heartedly. I go big or I go home. Once I decided to use Instagram, I would be full on with it, posting beautiful pictures and engaging with the audience. I already had an impressive following on Twitter, so it was a matter of moving some of those followers over to Instagram. A photo shoot with InStyle gave me material for some behind-the-scenes pictures. These kind of shots are always fun and popular on Instagram, and I was able to follow up with pictures from the actual shoot, which was great as it completed the perfect mini Instagram story. It wasn't just a random lovely picture. Here was a pictorial storyboard of my day, the perfect way to use Instagram and engage with your followers. The pictures linked together to form a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it didn't hurt that in the final shots I had my hair and makeup done, and so actually looked quite good. A holiday later in the summer gave me a lot of Instagram material. Beautiful backgrounds, sea shots, group shots of summer clothes and shoes, and the occasional picture of Rodial products against the sand. Easy peasy. Over time, I added shots of beautiful everyday objects, such as a magazine I was reading. Coffee shots with a pair of sunglasses do very well too. I like to occasionally post a Rodial product, but I would always try and give it an interesting angle or ensure that I have a story to share about this product. My gallery would never be a Rodial skincare catalogue. When I started, I was taking all the pictures on my iPhone. And you can tell. As I got more into Instagram, I started to carry a CyberShot Sony lens with me everywhere and would take pictures at every opportunity. I'm at a stage right now where I won't post a picture unless it's aesthetically pleasing. Having been in love with and worked for fashion magazines since I was a girl, I naturally want to curate a beautiful feed that is on the level of a magazine editorial shoot. If you have a good eye for photography and you can get to grips with the new digital cameras and filters, there is a lot you can do as an amateur photographer. By September 2014, I had developed a more concise Instagram strategy, posting twice a day, morning and evening. This allows me to connect with different time zones and have enough material to keep me going. If I travel or have an event or a shoot that would give me more material, I would post up to 4 times a day, but never more as I don't want to annoy my followers. So Instagram worked for me. Recently, Instagram launched a new platform called Instagram Stories that I'm really excited about. I have already grown my audience and can add short videos and pictures to share behind the scenes. But there are only so many hours in the day, and I'm not sure I have quite enough time to properly curate another platform. What about all the other platforms out there? I have tried getting into Pinterest, read a book, set up an account. I didn't get it, so I gave up on that. I got really excited with Snapchat too, and started an account and started posting daily, everyday elements of my life. A couple of weeks into it, I stopped. Why? I spend so much time preparing and curating everything that goes on my social media right now that I cannot justify spending any time on a platform that makes its content disappear within 24 hours. I have also decided that I need to focus on just one platform